So there's a distinction which periodically is made in between being and doing. And usually when people make this distinction, they consider doing the problem. And certainly it's our doings which tend to cause our sufferings. But not all doing causes suffering. But because so many people are striving so much or so overly actively doing, trying to do too much or too ambitious in the doing, or that people point to the doing as being the problem, and if you just rest in your being, just be, then everything will be just fine. And one of the kind of unfortunate manifestations of this is a misunderstanding that being is just a passive phenomenon, just like me being Mr. Natural, just hangs out and doesn't do anything. Not understanding that out of being can come a doing also. So in Buddhism, this distinction doesn't exist between being and doing. Rather, the distinction is it doesn't quite represent Buddhism either, but just begin to get to there, I'll do it in steps. The distinction in Buddhism is more like between being and becoming. And what's problematic in Buddhism is the movement of becoming. And becoming here means doing things with a little extra agenda. Doing things in order to become someone in a way that is a little bit anxiety-producing and neurotic, or creates kind of artificial senses of who we are. So a very, very mundane example is you can choose the clothes you're going to wear out of functionality. And perhaps some people have roles they have to play in society, so they wear clothes that belong to that role. Or you can choose the clothes you wear out of a need or desire to impress people. And that the need to impress people is an extra bit of becoming. We want to become something in the eyes of other people. Or we want to become something in our own eyes in order to create an impression, in order to create a sense of identity. We want people to see us in a particular way. So it isn't just simply putting on clothes for its function of keeping us warm or whatever, but it's putting on clothes for this movement of becoming, creating something, making us into something that maybe we're not exactly. And so this movement of becoming, of creating, making us into ourselves into something to make an impression to ourselves or to other people, to create a sense of identity, in Buddhism, is explained, tends to cause a lot of suffering. Now, the opposite side of that distinction of this, just being versus becoming, being is a little bit simplistic also, because being implies just being the status quo. So if you're the kind of person who likes to impress people, well, I'm just going to continue being that way, thank you. So in the sense that being can be misunderstood as just kind of, well, I'm just going to accept who I am. And who I am is, you know, person who's constantly trying to create a self-identity that everyone else sees. Then I'll just continue that way. The distinction that's more Buddhistic maybe be between, and this doesn't work in English, of course, between becoming and unbecoming, being becoming and being unbecoming. And maybe the better word, the more Buddhist word actually is between the distinction between becoming and the unfabricated, the unmade, the unconstructed. And the sense of doing that Buddhism kind of in a sense points at is that functioning of life, that functioning of our mind, of consciousness, which doesn't have to make anything happen, which doesn't have to, that aspect of awareness, of consciousness, which is unbecoming, which is unmanufactured, uncreated. Most of our states of mind that we live in are not our fabricated states of mind. They're states of mind that arise because we want to create something. We have an expectation of what's supposed to happen, and so we're trying to, the mind is then propelled forward with that expectation, with that desire, that ambition, or that aversion. And the mind is constantly preoccupied, it's a very good word, preoccupied with the objects of the mind, with the objects of awareness. And the way in which the mind is preoccupied with its concerns creates the kind of consciousness that you have at any one moment. So if you are preoccupied with an object of desire, and you're really lusting after that, or really, you know, desiring it, or preoccupied in getting it, that shakes that consciousness for that moment. That consciousness is a consciousness which is concerned with making something happen. And when you're filled with aversion for something, and you really hate something, you really want to push it away, I don't want that, then it's a consciousness which has a making as part of it. It's a constructed, a created consciousness. How that consciousness in that moment is made out of that aversion. Today, in the Sunday paper, we got a came in plastic wrap. I don't know if it happened to you. We get the Chronicle, and inside the Chronicle was this little jar, smallest jar I've ever seen, kind of really small jar, of anti-wrinkle cream. So what state of consciousness gets born, gets created, when this wonderful little anti-wrinkle cream shows up? Is it a state of mind? Is it a consciousness which is what gets created, the kind of consciousness gets created? Is it a consciousness, an awareness of mind, which, oh great, this is a great thing, I really always wanted to have a face without any wrinkles, here's my chance. And so it's filled with desire. Or is it a consciousness and awareness which is born out of aversion? Oh, my wrinkles, I've been reminded of them. I just woke up, it's Sunday morning, I wasn't thinking about it, and now I get the paper, and oh my God, you know, this is embarrassing, and, you know, and I hate my face. And so that kind of consciousness gets born. It's also possible to have a consciousness, or a state of mind, or a mind, which is unbecoming, or unmade is a better word, uncreated, unfabricated, which is not fabricated out of our desire, not fabricated out of our aversion, not fabricated out of our reactivity, out of a desire to become something, or to be something, or push something away, or obliterate something, but rather doesn't create anything, doesn't want to create anything, and maybe isn't created by anything also. So, becoming, which in Buddhism is a problem, versus the unmade mind, the unmade presence, a presence of being which doesn't need anything to happen, is not trying to create anything to happen. So in the kind of analysis of the human condition, Buddhism tends to be process-oriented. That human condition is, we're often involved in processes. And so there's a particular process which is a process of becoming. And the process of becoming is cyclical. It goes in a circle. So, and there's another process which is a process towards freedom, towards the unmade, towards that present which is unfabricated, that doesn't need anything to happen, doesn't want anything to happen, that's not trying to make something happen, but just resting in what's called the unfabricated. And that is not a circle, but rather, some people call it a spiral, or some people just, when they diagram it, just have it a straight line out, you know, a straight line. But it doesn't go circular. It doesn't come back and feed itself. So these two kind of processes are very important in Buddhism, And both of them begin with dukkha. And a few weeks ago, I talked about suffering. As many of you know, our suffering is, the dukkha, translated usually as suffering in English, is kind of often the beginning place where Buddhists like to analyze the human condition. Because Buddhism is concerned about how to end suffering. So we start there and go, let's look at that part of human life. Like a doctor, you know, if you have, you know, some kind of, you know, if you have gallstones, you know, and that's your condition, you're in a lot of pain, you don't go to the doctor, you go to the doctor and say, well, you know, I'm having some trouble. And they say, well, they ask you, well, you know, we were wondering, you know, how your ingrown toenail is. How's that doing today? But you don't want, if you're suffering a gallstone infection or whatever it is, you don't want the doctor to ask about your toenails. You want them to really deal with the issue at hand, which is the gallstone. So Buddhism, and if they want to be free of suffering, they say we should study our suffering. The word dukkha is better translated perhaps as a generic word in English as unsatisfactoriness. And maybe in a way that can be understood by many of us in our lives is when the Buddha said that life has inherent aspect of unsatisfactoriness, maybe another way of saying is life is built into an inherent sense of limitation. All of us as human beings are living limited human lives. We cannot follow unlimited opportunities. There's limitation. As we get older, there's more and more limitations that our body puts on us, our mind puts on us, our circumstances place us under. And there's always some limitation. So the mind, in a sense, maybe the fabricated mind, the mind that wants, the mind that has aversion, just wants to have unlimited opportunities to do whatever it wants. But we encounter the world, which puts limitations on us, and some people it puts closer limitations than others. So the word dukkha maybe can be translated into English as limitation. How do we cope with the inherent limitations of being a human being? And some of these limitations we don't see until they actually occur. And I love it, you know, I've said it many times now, that Sunday morning we're sitting literally right on top of the San Andreas Fault. Maybe none of you will come back now. And, you know, we're sitting here quite happily and contently, and this floor is very solid, thank you. And, you know, it seems like we can trust the solidity of the floor. But it could suddenly, just from moment to another, just buckle very nicely. One wave goes through, and you always thought that asphalt, you know, slab floors were quite solid. So there's an inherent limitation like that, you know, that we can't rely on the solidity of the floors and the earth. So how do we relate to limitation? How do we relate to things which are unsatisfactory? How do we relate to the sufferings of our life when our life suffers? So Buddha intends to begin the analysis there. And then there's two forks that arise out of our encounter with suffering. And to realize these two forks is very important so you can choose the right fork. One fork is cyclical. And that is the fork of becoming. So we encounter some unsatisfactories of life, limitations of life. And then desire arises. We would like it to be different. We would like to have more happiness. We would like to have more greater sense of identity. We'd like to have a Porsche. We'd like to have all kinds of nice things we'd like to have. And that desire in itself is pretty innocent, perhaps. We don't want to make a problem out of simple desire. But that desire very quickly, maybe immediately, is entangled with craving. I gotta have this. It has to happen. You know, a desire which is just kind of just floating is fine, but desire which then is channeled into energy, into a contraction in the body, into action, Buddhism calls craving. Or can be called craving. And craving is a demand for something to be a certain way. As a kind of sense of demand or expectation or a sense of neediness, so this is the way it needs to be. And that's so desire gives birth to craving, and craving, as we follow through on it, gives birth to becoming. To becoming something. Something manufactured, something created comes into being. And what is it can be simply a habit formation. That every time we act out of hate or act out of clinging or desire or craving. We create the conditions, a habit condition, for that for us to respond that way more in the future. I've seen in my own mind that days where I tend to be filled with lots of desire and really trying to do a lot of things and get a lot done, and then I sit down to meditate, I can feel the momentum of that craving in my mind, and it makes me kind of impatient when I sit there. It kind of creates a trick in my mind. Oh, there's more important things to be done here. I've got to get this stuff done, you know. I've got to, you know, whatever it is. And it can be very compelling, the momentum of desire, the momentum of making and becoming and creating that the mind gets into. It can be very innocent, the things that we have to get done in our life, but we get involved in them in kind of ahead of ourselves. We get involved with them kind of a desperation or neediness. It has to be done. And when that happens, if you sit down, what you'll notice is the momentum is there of habit formation, of creating and making and doing. And you can sit down to meditate, and it can be seen so much more important to defrost the freezer than it is to continue sitting there, because that momentum is still there. And that movement of becoming, that kind of becoming that Buddhism is talking about, then creates something, and that creation of it creates suffering. For no other reason, because it's impermanent. And it passes away. But in that, the kind of becoming, the kind of manufacturing of a state of consciousness, the kind of mind we make, that involves clinging or contraction in its making, tends then to lead to further suffering. Something becomes, it's impermanent, it passes away, we're disappointed. Something becomes, and we create a certain habit formation of reacting that way in the future. And so it tends to create another point of suffering as a result of following through on that. And then we're back at the beginning of the cycle again. How do we react and respond to suffering? So it can be a cycle where we react in a certain way to unsatisfactory limitations of life. And that itself creates further suffering. And so we react the same way again. Does this make some sense to you? And so it becomes a cycle of reactivity. A cycle of reactivity. Over and over again, we react maybe in the same similar ways. And many people live their lives in these cycles. Over and over and over again, these cycles. We react a certain way, that reaction creates the conditions for further suffering. We react the same way again because we don't like suffering, and so it goes around and around. The other process is a process towards the unfabricated, towards the unmade presence, towards the unmade consciousness or mind, the unfabricated. And that begins also by our encounter with suffering. But we choose to relate to suffering in a different way. And we choose to relate to suffering not through our normal reactions of greed, of hate, of desire, of wishing, of fear. But rather, we see that in that suffering is, that suffering is there because of a way that we've chosen to relate to the world. And you're going to choose now to relate a different way. And we're going to choose to relate to the world by not reacting to it. We're going to choose to react to the suffering that we encounter, the specific sufferings we encounter, by beginning to bring a spiritual practice to it. We're going to see it as an opportunity, as a place to begin a different way, a whole different way of relating to the world. So 3 weeks ago I talked about suffering. And I talk a lot about this, about how we work with suffering, we practice with suffering. We can see it as an opportunity to not be in a reactive mode, but we see it as an opportunity to practice mindfulness, to practice awareness, to practice just being with it and seeing what happens when we just be with it rather than reacting to it. And then the following week, I talked about faith, if you remember, confidence. The process of leading towards freedom, leading towards the unmade presence, the unfabricated presence, begins with suffering And then there's 12 steps that the Buddha laid out. The first step is just encountering suffering, having a wise relationship to suffering, understanding the nature of our limitations, the nature of our the unsatisfactoriness of a life, the nature of our suffering, the nature of how we create our suffering. It's very important to understand this really well. And then see if we can relate to the suffering in a wiser way. And that wiser way of relating to suffering, hopefully, gives birth to confidence, or trust, or faith. Oh, I know another way. I know a way that doesn't lend me to endless cycles of repetition. I know a way that leads me towards freedom, to the possibility of not being caught up in my reactivity. And to know that, and to have the examples of other people who have done that. The Buddha is a great model, but other people who have stepped off the endless cycles of constantly reacting. And to have some confidence in that that's a possibility. To stop the normal reactivities. So suffering is a prerequisite for that kind of confidence. Oh, it's possible not to continue this. That confidence then is a prerequisite for the next step of these 12 steps. And that is, surprisingly, is delight. And so the third step is delight, and the fourth step is joy. Isn't this great? So you've been waiting for this, you know. We've been talking so much about suffering. Where's the joy? Where's the delight? The delight and the joy. So out of our encounter with suffering, there needs to be some experience of confidence that there is another way than being mired in this process. There has to be another way than opening up the Sunday paper and seeing the anti-wrinkle cream. There has to be another way than just simply, you know, suffering because of it. You know, oh my God, you know, this is such a small container, and you know, I wonder, you know, what kind of, not enough for one day even, what kind of stores open, and I don't have gas in my car, and, you know, and I have to get, you know, but I have to drive down there, you know, and get it, but then I have to drive down there and get it. I'm driving this car I don't want anybody to see me in, and because it's so old and beat up, and, you know, maybe I can go rent a car so people see me in a nicer way, so I can go to the store, and, you know, the kind of stores that sell these creams, you know, probably are more upscale stores, and so I need an upscale car, and, you know, and so off the mind goes, right? But rather just see I'm beginning to suffer against this reaction. There must be another way to this, another way. And have some confidence in another way. And that confidence beginning to pull us out of that reactive mode of being. Have some confidence that there's another way. We don't have to follow that road. So after the confidence comes delight. And this is very difficult for, I think, us Westerners to understand how the Buddha defined this delight. Out of this confidence is another way. Comes the reflection that, yes, I'm going to follow this other way. And that requires me to have a certain level of self-respect. It's very difficult to follow a spiritual life unless we have a certain level of self-respect, self-contentment. And it's a self-respect that comes from knowing that when we've decided to follow the other way, really clear for us, we're going to follow the other way, that I'm no longer going to lead an unethical life. I'm no longer going to lead a life which harms other people. I'm not going to lead a life that involves stealing, even small things. I'm not going to lead a life that leads to my callous disregarding life of other beings, either even insects. I'm going to be very careful with my conduct from this point onwards. I might have done terrible things in the past. From this point onward, I'm really going to decide I'm going to try to live a better life. And the degree to better life is all you have to negotiate, what's workable for you. But to some degree, I'm going to live a better life. The Buddha's expectation was that once you make that decision, that to some degree you're going to live a better life, you're going to feel delight. based on that decision. How easy it is for you. Do you guys feel some delight when you decide to live a better life? Great. So the Buddha said, you have to feel that delight. That delight is really great. It's really important to have that kind of delight. To choose to live a better life. And from the moment you decide that, to rejoice, to feel delight in that now you're living that way to some degree, trying to at least. So the delight of feeling some self-respect, the delight of feeling some personal sense of integrity, the delight of knowing that there's another way of living here, the delight of knowing I can begin to take some responsibility for the choices that my mind makes, choices of what I chase after or what I avert. So this, of course, takes mindfulness, and that's why it's a mindfulness practice. We begin practicing again to be mindful of our choices, mindful of our behavior, mindful of what we do with our mind, and we then choose to do a better job. And from that, hopefully, you're supposed to feel delight. But it's not so easy for a lot of Westerners to feel delight in themselves, because the conditioning of feeling bad about ourselves or being convinced that something is wrong with us fundamentally is so ingrained in some of us. The cycles of reactivity, cycles of becoming, get really embedded in our psyche. And one of the ways it gets embedded is feelings of tremendous lack of confidence, tremendous sense of lack of self-esteem, tremendous sense of I'm unworthy. And it becomes a kind of self-perpetuating cycle of becoming. And so you need to have very strong mindfulness sometimes to step out of that cycle so that we can begin experiencing some delight in who we are, in the choices we've made. And it's really helpful to have that sense of delight. The Buddha put it as a third step. You encounter suffering. From your encounter to suffering, from your wisdom and understanding of another possibility comes a confidence. That confidence grows with time. From that confidence then comes a decision to live a different life. Not to add a spiritual life to all not to think that the world is full of unlimited opportunities. I'm just going to barrel ahead and do exactly what I was doing before. No changes at all. But I'm going to have a sprinkling of spirituality in there supposed to lubricate it and make it all just perfect. I think that some people operate that way. And I think that's really naive. But out of that confidence that another way is possible, to choose to live a little different life. I don't know how different for you, but at least a life maybe that is ethical. And then to feel delight in that. If you've been taking pencils from work, or the equivalent of that, I don't know what it is, the equivalent of that might be, but no one's told you you can do that. And you decide, I'm going to stop doing that. Can that be a source of delight? As opposed to, oh yeah, I'm not doing it, you know, boy am I foolish. A source of delight and joy from that. So from that delight, and that's a condition that helps us feel joy, which is the fourth step in this process towards freedom. And joy is a very important element of meditation in the spiritual life. So the question is, how can we cultivate joy? How can joy become part and parcel of our spiritual life? Without some degree of joy, it's very hard to get concentrated. Without some degree of joy, it's very hard to have a healthy kind of peacefulness. The fifth step is peace, peacefulness. To have some peace or contentment or ease of being. Without some joy, it's hard to have some ease or peace. Without some ease and peace, it's hard to get concentrated. Without being concentrated, it's hard to have happiness. And without some degree of happiness, it's hard to have to see what's really true in life. And without really seeing what's true, it's hard, really hard to do the deeper work of choosing the unfabricated, choosing going in the direction of that state, that presence which is not created by anything. Or turning away subtly from the constant cycles of fabrication or creating. And without turning away from the constant patterns of creation, it's hard to set the mind to totally and completely free. So we have suffering, we have confidence, we have delight that comes from a kind of reflection about our integrity. And then comes joy, the fourth step. Can you allow yourself to experience joy in your meditation at least? Can you look for joy? Can you appreciate the arising of joy? It's not always there by any means, but maybe it's there more often than you realize. Maybe it's something you can cultivate more in your meditation. I know for me, if I sit down to meditate and I'm quite agitated, or if I'm suffering around something, I have a certain element of joy because I know how healthy and useful it is to sit down and meditate and create some a space of awareness around that agitation. I actually feel some joy from that. Wow, this is really great. I have enough experience now that I know this is a really fantastic thing to do. And I actually feel some joy wells up inside of me in the midst of that, all that agitation difficulty I might have. To experience your breathing. And maybe to find, is there some sense of joy or comfort or ease in the breathing as we breathe? Sometimes there can be. And then to allow that sense of joy to arise and to tickle you, to delight you, to feed you. The word joy is in Pali is piti. And sometimes in Buddhism it's translated in other ways besides joy. Sometimes it's translated by the word enthusiasm. Sometimes by the word interest. The joy that's born out of this kind of joy is a joy that's born out of a real interest in the process of freedom, real interest in paying attention to carefully to our breathing or to whatever the focus of our attention might be. To feel that it's valuable, it has purpose, that it leads to freedom. You know, I think many of us have the experience when we really engage in some activity we really love doing, the sense of time might drop away. Sense of our concerns and even the world drops away. We're just totally involved in our activity, our hobby, or whatever it might be. The interest is really powerful. It's possible to have that level of timeless interest, enthusiasm, for something like our breathing or our mindfulness meditation, just moment by moment. What's happening now? What's happening now? And to begin cultivating that interest, oh, this is really interesting to do that. My breath or my moment-to-moment experience is so interesting. It actually has greater value than sitting here wondering about anti-wrinkle cream, or wondering about car payments, or wondering about, you know, what video to rent for tonight, or whatever, you know, direction your mind might go. Kind of, it seems so interesting in the moment. As our interest in the meditation, we can feel more settled and committed, have more confidence. I'm going to sit here and be here in the present moment with this activity, with this focus. Greater and greater interest comes, and greater enthusiasm comes. It becomes kind of like a feedback loop. There's a healthy cycle. The greater the interest, the greater the joy. The greater the joy, the greater the interest. And so the joy that can arise sometimes in meditation sometimes is called a rapture. And the Buddhist texts describe five different kinds of rapture you might experience in your meditation. There's minor joy or minor rapture. There's a momentary rapture. There's, I'm not sure how best translated, but cascading or cascading maybe is the best word. Cascading, it feels like waves washing over you, one wave after the other. This wave, you know, it's like this huge. It's kind of like an orgasm to, you know, 10 degrees more strong, or, you know, 10 times stronger than an orgasm, because it's so thoroughly. There's waves of cascading, pounding, full bodily wave of just rapture and joy that just passes through the body. And then there can be transporting joy, the fourth kind, which it feels like you're being lifted off the ground. In the ancient texts, they say you actually are. You can actually fly different places when you have this level of joy. I don't know, but at least it feels that way. And then there can be the joy of, and then the last fifth one is all-pervading. Just you feel like a balloon which has been blown up to its capacity. You feel so filled with capacity, just bursting, ready to burst with delight. But whether it's that intense or whether it's just very kind of small, subtle joy, joy is a very important element of the path. But in order to feel joy, there has to be a sense that it's not only okay to feel it, but that it's appropriate to feel it, and that maybe it's there more often than you realize. And it's a matter of kind of looking for it, or relaxing, or opening to the possibility of it being there. Because when we're so consumed with our preoccupations, the preoccupations don't allow us any space in the mind to notice the joy that might be there. And there's a lot more joy in our lives than most people will admit or allow for. It doesn't take much to experience some joy for many people. You know, maybe this is a dramatic example, but yesterday I went to the beach with my son. And, and we had this wonderful time on the beach together, and then I put him in the car seat, and I sat in the front seat of the car. And for some reason, he was really content sitting there. And I gave him his cracker. He was eating his cracker. And he was content to be left alone for a while. And I was all concerned about making sure he was happy and everything. And there was this movement of becoming, this movement of preoccupation and concern. And, it was a cycle of my reactivity to him. He has to be happy, and I have to make him happy and make sure he's well fed. And because if I don't, then he's going to want even more from me. And I was like a little bit preoccupied in this world of taking care of him, this cyclic world of parenting. And so it took me a while to realize that he was basically didn't mean anything for me. And probably could have realized a little bit earlier. But I was like, in my cycles, right? I felt like, anyway, wow, it doesn't mean anything. Let me just sit here and relax in the driver's seat and look out at the ocean. And all this joy was right there. It wasn't very far away. All I had to do was stop my preoccupation with his happiness. And it was there. Wow. At the ocean, looking at the big waves. I don't know if that was a good example for you, but... So I thought of talking about this today because I had noticed that a few weeks ago, I talked about suffering, and the following week I talked about faith or trust or confidence. And then I remembered, actually, that's the beginning of these 12 steps towards freedom that the Buddha laid out, the process towards freedom. That's the alternative to the cyclic process of becoming and suffering. So then I'll talk a little bit about joy, delight and joy. And then I thought I'd better explain where it comes from, why I'm doing it now. So that's my thoughts for today. I didn't cover joy and delight very well, but... You're not going to be preoccupied by that, are you? So we have 5 minutes. If you want to react or have comments or questions to what I said. Yes?
I'm working with loving kindness meditation, by the way. I was wondering if the difference between may I be happy or the affirmation, kind of new age of I am happy. Uh-huh. Is that anything to do with what you're talking about now? I'm seeing some kind of maybe connection, or why do we turn may I be into I am?
So I can feel joy, just the fact that she asked that question. Oh. She wants to know the difference between the Buddhist loving kindness meditation, where the phrase is "May I be happy," versus what she called the New Age practice of affirmation, where you say "I am happy."
Seems like it's related to what you're saying. Like, I am happy. I'm happy at this moment. You just strive.
Right. So she says it seems to be related, and I then kind of sidestep the question immediately by taking an opportunity to point out that, see, I could have been very preoccupied with her answer and with my sense of becoming. Oh, I better please her, I better have a wise answer, or, you know, all these people are listening, I'm supposed to be his teacher, you know, and in order to be a teacher, I better kind of have a good answer for all of you. And that's the cycle of becoming. I need to become something and create something, a good answer. And that just creates more suffering to do that kind of way. Or I could just kind of take a moment and relax, not be preoccupied with that. And notice, that's a great question. And the fact that there's a human being who is interested in that kind of question actually brings delight to me. I mean, wow, someone who tries to explore this issue of loving kindness and happiness and how it comes about. And it's great. So I take the opportunity to feel more joy in the question than I do in how good this answer is. So, but you're still waiting for an answer.
Very well.
So the difference between an affirmation "I am happy" and "May I be happy"? It might be that you are happy, and being reminded of that by an affirmation might be the really wise thing to do. I mean, I think there tends to be more happiness under the surface if we just turn to it than sometimes we realize. If we're really preoccupied sometimes. But the movement of affirmation sometimes, and the reason I distrust it is because sometimes, not always, it tends to be an overlay of a demand. This is the way things should be. And sometimes it does change our consciousness and we can feel happier as a result. But it tends to be a happiness which is all too easily kind of a superficial overlay on top of the actual movements of our psychology. And Buddhism tends to focus more on understanding what's our reactive psychology in a deeper way so we can uproot it once and for all rather than to overlay a nice veneer over it. Loving kindness practice, "May I be happy," it gets born out of some confidence that, yeah, it's possible to be happy. I might not be happy right now. It's possible to be happy. And it's a really beautiful thing to have that intention that I'd be happy. I don't know if I'm going to... It's kind of like the "May I be happy" intention is kind of like... Buddhism doesn't say this because it's not a theistic religion, but it's kind of like saying, "May I be happy, God willing." You know, it's like the intention is there, and that intention is very powerful. It plants a seed, which gives fruit. But we don't know when. That intention is a beautiful thing in and of itself. And if you properly understood, to have that intention for your own happiness can bring happiness itself. You want to be happy, but the desire for the intention, when done wisely, is a happiness-producing state of mind. So sometimes, if you say, "May I be happy," when I say, "May I be happy," sometimes my happiness is just right there. And I just feel all this happiness just in the moment. That's all it took, was to say, "May I be happy, may I wish for that happiness to be there." And sometimes it's not there, but the fact that I'm practicing and fueling, or in a sense, or feeding the intention, "May I be happy," conditions me in the future for that happiness to be more likely to arise and to surface. So the loving kindness practice is strengthening an intention. The affirmation is kind of an overlay. And the intention, I think, if it's done, hopefully with the loving kindness, it's strengthening an intention which is sincere. May I am happy as an affirmation may or may not be sincere. It may be, born out of tremendous aversion of your state of being. So, okay, I am happy no matter what. You know, or so, So is that approaching an acceptable answer?
I was just wondering if one great disciple is coming.
It's a little bit awkward to say this, but they both create cycles of becoming. Loving kindness meditation also creates a cycle of becoming, but it's a healthier cycle. You can participate in the cycle of becoming in healthier and unhealthier ways. And there are healthier ways. They still perpetuate the cycle of becoming and creation and becoming. But loving kindness participates in the cycle, but tends to create a healthier cycle. It's possible they're really healthy cycles. There's a lot of happiness and joy in it, but it's still cyclical, and it's not the same thing as freedom. But the loving kindness, as it creates a healthier cycle, makes for a much better jumping off place for freedom to happen. Yes?
Can you say something about how the concept of right action fits together with the notion of unbecoming?
Oh. Maybe it ties to what I just said now, that in the cyclic world of becoming, we can create maybe it's like the cyclic world like a cylinder rather than like a hoop, and on that and we go around and around in the cylinder, and down at the bottom of the cylinder is like in a can, right? And the bottom of the can is all rusted and kind of sharp and painful. And then you get near the top where it's been kind of above the moisture or whatever, it's really smooth and shiny and just like you can just kind of put your ice skates on and just kind of skate around really easily, really, you know, happily. But you're still on wholesome, which are skillful, which are conducive towards going up higher in that cylinder. And unwholesome actions are conducive to going down to where the rust and the sharp corners are and stuff. And then to say it differently, that the choices we make of how we're going to choose to act have consequences. And if we choose to act out of hate, that tends to, when the circle comes around again, what goes around comes around, they say, right? So if we act out of hate, it tends to condition further suffering and further habit formations of hate. It tends to drop us in lower level on the cylinder. If we act out of love, what comes around goes around. What goes around comes around. So if we act on love, it comes around again to further becoming. But we tend to float up to the top of the cylinder where it's really nice. We're still in the cylinder. Freedom is getting off the cylinder. It's easier to get off the cylinder if you're not at the bottom with all the rust and all that, which all really difficult. So right action is the action that tends to help us create the conditions so that it's easier for us to step off. So, for example, if you just did a whole bunch of awful things the last week, just did a lot of terrible things, or were lost, consumed in desire and ambition, or consumed with hate and ill will towards everyone else around you, just consumed in all this stuff. When you sit down to meditate, that momentum is still there. It's very hard to see, I have a different choice. It just seems so compelling to be filled with hate or ambition. But if you choose to act out of more love and out of more generosity, then when you sit down to meditate, that love and generosity probably hasn't created the same force of preoccupation, and it's going to be a lot easier to see, it's possible to respond to this in a non-reactive way, and therefore then stepping off the cycles of reactivity. Does that make some sense?
It makes some sense, but it seems to make the goal inaction.
The goal in action. The goal is in action. The goal is, in a sense, is to know that there is a possibility to experience the unfabricated, the unmade aspect of reality, unmade, unfabricated mind. That does not lead us to become passive, but rather leads us to actions, to activity in the world, which is not tainted by anything extra. Any sense of ego, of any sense of wanting to become something, any sense of trying to create something for the mind. As some people say, there's no traces in the action, there's no traces of ego. So people who are enlightened still go around doing all kinds of stuff. You know, they go pee and eat their food and help other people and do different things. But there's nothing extra about it. And so there's an unfabricated aspect to it. There's a presence. They're kind of like there's a sense of there's a presence that they're at home in, which doesn't require them to be anything for anyone, including for themselves. But to discover that presence, it's helpful to create healthy conditions, like the delight, like the delight that arises out of feeling your own integrity. Creates healthy conditions that makes it a lot easier then to step out of the cycle of reactivity into that unfabricated presence. And how you choose to act once you're in that unfabricated presence, that's up to you. Buddhism doesn't tend to give a prescription of how you're supposed to be once you're there. Maybe. So this is this teaching that I kind of did very briefly today is considered to be a very profound part of Buddhist teaching and Buddhist practice, and if it didn't make any sense because I covered it too quickly or too simplistically, I apologize, and if it confused you, just it was very valuable to grapple with it and try to understand it better. If it confused you, but if it really bugs you, then just leave it here. So thank you for your listening so carefully.